So I'd like to thank the organizers of this really wonderful workshop. Frankly, it's one of the few ones where I have listened to every talk. I mean, this is without sleeping. But that was really nice, and for giving me the opportunity to present this little bit of an offbeat subject. So an important slogan in string theory, which we all love and all say in some time talking, is that string, space and time are derived notions. However, for most cases, we do not know what this deeper structure is. Luckily, in some cases, we have some hints, and these are the cases which involve a holographic description and where the holographic description is somewhat known. And I'll list them in chronological order. The first case, which will be the subject of today's talk, is in fact two-dimensional string theory, where the holographic description is the quantum mechanics of a single matrix. The second case is DLCQM theory, where the holographic description is the quantum mechanics, supersymmetric quantum mechanics of many matrices. And the third, I shouldn't call it third, but a whole lot of cases, which has got to do with strings which are living in asymptotically antideciduous spaces, where the holographic duals of gauge theory is typically in higher dimensions, which is probably the most interesting situations. These are all gauge theories at large N, and for the first and the third ones, the strings arise in a fashion which was entirely as it was thought about by its host, say, in the 1970s. The second situation is somewhat different because the large N limit, which is performed, is a bit unconventional, and in fact it's sort of not so well understood in this particular context. Among these examples, the first one and the earliest enjoys the privilege of having a sector of the holographic theory which is exactly solvable. Another example which has come up in recent years is a kind of a theory of the same spirit, which goes by the name of minimal string theory, as being pursued by Seiberg and collaborators. In fact, the recent realization over the past couple of years that matrix quantum mechanics is in fact an example of an open-closed duality makes this a useful toy model, which may have lessons for higher dimensions as well. And obviously, one of the aspects which one would like to understand in this theory are time-dependent processes. And indeed, the recent resurgence of interest in this model in was kicked off by looking at a very important time-dependent process, which is a rolling tachyon background. And it was followed later on by time-dependent, large time-dependent backgrounds, which sort of differ from this case in the sense that the rolling tachyon can be considered as genuinely considered as a state in the theory, where here we are really talking about different backgrounds of a grand string field theory, which sometimes goes by the name of matrix cosmology. Time-dependent backgrounds in this theory has in fact been studied for a long time. It was studied in the first incarnation of the theory in the early 90s and later on, in recent years by Alexander, Kazakov, and Kostov, but I guess its use in trying to understand some physical aspects of cosmologies has been sort of pioneered by Kaczmarek and Strominger. So I'll talk about these latter class of processes, and my talk will be based on three preprints which have listed here, and some work in progress, and my main aim will be to understand how space and time emerge from matrices in this toy model. In this process, I will also explore some physical processes in these backgrounds, in particular particle production in some time-dependent backgrounds, and the implications of string theory. We will consider the modern version of this theory, which goes by the name of zero beam theory, which was written down by these people. And I'll just quickly summarize what the physical content of this theory is. The dynamical propagating modes of this theory consist of two massless fields. One, for historical reasons, is called an axion, tachyon, and the other is an axion. The second is a good name, the first is not. As in two-dimensional string theories, gravity in this theory is non-propagating, but it does have non-trivial backgrounds. Or in other words, whereas there is no graviton, there's certainly the Coulomb mode of the longitudinal Coulomb mode of gravity, which can give rise to interesting backgrounds. These backgrounds are sometimes written in terms of an infinite tower of discrete states at fixed values of momentum and fixed values of energy. So these are not really fields, they are like fixed backgrounds. And the coupling constant of this theory, which these fields observe, is in fact space dependent, which in fact follows from the physics of a Liouville wall. So basically what you have is like a potential, this is space, and you know, this quanta coming in, and in the process of getting reflected from this wall, it produces lots of particles leading to a non-trivial bulk S matrix. So that's the string theory side. The holographic dual, as I said, is a quantum mechanics of a single n by n matrix M, Hermitian n by n matrix, which is gauged by a gauge field with a symmetry group which is un. In one dimension, of course, a gauge field doesn't have much of a content. What it does, in fact, is to ensure a Gauss law constraint, which tells you that all the states of this theory, without any additional Wilson loops or something, are singlets. This means that one can pick a gauge in which I can diagonalize this matrix and rewrite the dynamics of this theory in terms of eigenvalues. And as has been well known, because of a non-trivial measure factor, these eigenvalues can be regarded as coordinates of n fermions, each of these fermions living in an inverted harmonic oscillator potential. So the picture is roughly like this. This is what an individual, what this potential is. We usually think of this with the infrared cutoff, which is not going to be important for the purposes of our talk. The ground state of this theory are, you know, infinite number of fermions which fill up the Fermi C up to a level which is labeled by mu. And there are small fluctuations of the Fermi C which are interpreted as two scalar fields. And there are large fluctuations with a gap where we take a bunch of fermions from below the Fermi C and raise it up. And these are associated with zero brains of this model. This is the story in a certain double scaling limit of the theory where the number of fermions are equivalently the group SUN, n tends to infinity, with this parameter mu, which denotes both at the Fermi level as well as the coupling constant of the theory, the inverse coupling constant theory, fixed. And following standard ideas of the 1 upon n expansion, we would believe that this should be a string theory. Because any large n theory in the 1 upon n expansion, a theory with adjoint matrices at large n, should look like a string theory, with a string coupling constant which scales at the inverse power of n. What was, of course, realized, a bit surprising at that time, in the 90s, that the string theory lives not in 0 plus 1 dimensions, but in 1 plus 1 dimensions. And in fact, in our modern interpretation, the small ripples which I drew on the two sides will be related to linear combinations of the tachyon and the axion, which live in the same space via a transform which I'll mention and which is non-local at the string scale. So in a sense, it is clear that the holographic theory doesn't have any space. It has only time. So it's a well-defined time evolution. And space is sort of invented in this model from the space of eigenvalues. But as we will soon see, the real notion of having a relativistic space-time is rather non-trivial, depending on the backgrounds. So let me remind you how space-time is produced in this model as perceived by fluctuations around the ground state. It's convenient to draw these pictures where one draws the phase space of fermions. So this is the momentum, and that's this coordinate x. And in this picture, because it's an inverted harmonic oscillator, these are the regions of the field Fermi C on the two sides. We think of a small fluctuation of Fermi C, so it sort of comes in this way, reflects back, and at that process produces, which in terms of the original scalar fields, are lots of particles. To map out the space-time at the classical level, and throughout this talk, when I talk about the classical level, I really mean the classical theory, classical shrink theory, which is the leading order in the large N expansion, it's useful to rewrite this problem in terms of what is called a collective field, which is basically the density of eigenvalues of the original matrix. And there, by well-known techniques, one can derive the action for this collective field, such as the Hamiltonian for this collective field, starting from the matrix itself. So this is the action which arises at the leading order in the large N expansion, as shown by the power of N squared, which is sitting right in front. And this looks, of course, like a two-dimensional field theory. And like in any field theory, in the perturbative expansion, what you would do is to look for a ground state solution, and this is the ground state solution by minimizing this potential, and perform fluctuations around the ground state solution to look at the physics of the excitations. It turns out that ground state or not, if I perform fluctuations around any classical solution of this theory, the fluctuation itself has a quadratic action which corresponds to a massless scalar field in 1 plus 1 dimensions. So this is the quadratic action. The metric, this being a massless scalar field in 1 plus 1 dimension, the kinetic term will not tell you what the metric is. It will only tell you the conformal class of the metric. And I've written that conform, the, one of member of the conformal class has chosen it so that it's a flat metric. Is given in terms of the time derivative of the classical solution and the space derivative of the classical solution. For the ground state, the classical solution is time independent, and this is what the metric looks like, and the fact that you had a cut in the eigenvalue distribution sort of reflects itself in the boundary condition of this field at this point, plus or minus square root of 2 mu. These are the two edges of the eigenvalue distribution here. That's right. I'll tell you, no. The X and T are not preferred. I'll tell you what are preferred in what sense in a moment. The interaction Hamiltonian, the classical interaction Hamiltonian is purely cubic, and it is written in terms of this. It is cubic when it's written in terms of the momenta, which are conjugate to eta. Of course, when we express this in terms of time derivatives of eta, it's an infinite series. And what we would like to understand is what kind of space-time this thing represents. Of course, as I said, in two dimensions, everything is conformal to flat. So we got to specify what we mean by this. So let me first go ahead. Since in two dimensions, you can always choose up to gauge transformation, you know, it is a conformal to flat, and I've chosen the metric to be flat, I can choose what I'll call Minkowskian coordinates. The Minkowskian coordinates are tau and sigma. What I mean is that the metric written in terms of these coordinates is minus d tau square plus d sigma square. And this is related by the original time t of the matrix model, and the space of eigenvalues x by this transformation. So two things I'd like to notice is that for this particular case, the two times are identical, and furthermore, the relationship between x and sigma is local and does not depend on the time. At the perturbative level, the fluctuations on the two sides are decoupled, and they live in two identical copies of the space-time separated by a mirror. And so a Penrose diagram would look like this. So this is the right side, things coming in from scribe minus, getting reflected to scribe plus, everything is completely almost boring. And of course, a non-trivial thing comes when you try to relate the space-time as defined by tau and sigma to what we call the space-time as seen by perturbative string theory defined by the world sheet. And that's a story which is still not understood in detail, but one knows some answers in this particular case, and the answer is as follows. You take the fluctuation field, and from linear combinations of those on the left and the right side, symmetric and antisymmetric combinations, and which define a field eta s and a, which are on the same side, that is, this x is just running from 0 to square root of mu, and the Fourier transforms of these fields are related to the string theory tachyon and the axion fields by a complicated transform like this, which when written in position space, what it means is that there is a transform with a non-Lucan kernel whose basic scale is in fact the string scale. So this means there's a string scale non-locality in the translation from the collective field theory to the string theory. I must emphasize that in a sense, in the asymptotic region, tau and sigma are time and space in terms of which the physics is most transparent. We could have, of course, chosen some other set of coordinates which are related by a conformal transformation. I mean, nothing prevents me from doing that. However, in terms of the specific tau and sigma, one has the property that the interaction Hamiltonian does not involve time explicitly. So the Hamiltonian is time independent in terms of this tau and sigma, and if you typically go to any other definition of tau and sigma, you will have an interaction which is time dependent and makes the interpretation rather different. But of course, you're going to get the same thing. I mean, whatever you calculate is calculating theory. The coupling, as you see, is time independent, but it depends on the space as defined by sigma, and in fact, it blows up at sigma equal to 0, which is the location of the mirror. And as I had emphasized before, what I call the left and the right side get mapped onto a single space in string theory by a transform which is smeared at the string scale. So this is the story for fluctuations around the ground state and shows in a very transparent way how time and space arises. And there is not much of a surprise in this. I mean, we sort of guess that it comes from the space of eigenvalues, and that's where it comes from. It just requires a little local transformations in order to map it into something which is usually recognizable.
So, I mean, is it fair to say that in this model, it's only the space that is an inversion
function? Absolutely, right. Like in ADS, it's the radial direction which emerges. I'll consider a class of classical solutions which are generated from the ground state solution by a set of symmetries of the Lagrangian of the theory, which goes by the name of W infinity transformations. These symmetries are in fact canonical transformations in the single fermion phase space. However, the charges for these symmetries do not commute with the Hamiltonian, even though they are conserved. And therefore, what the symmetries act are like spectrum, a kind of a spectrum generating algebra of the theory. So starting from the ground state, I can apply finite W infinity transformations and obtain solutions to the theory. The solutions to the theory can be written in many different ways, and one particular way of writing the solution is to express this by specifying what the Fermi surface of the theory is. And I've written down for you a class of such solutions which are parameterized by an integer r and some parameters lambda minus and lambda plus which represents the Fermi surface of the theory. This is nothing very insightful about this till I come to some examples. Now, it is well known by now that if I have a Fermi surface, a generic Fermi surface, which is a solution of the theory, it is not guaranteed that these will be classical solutions of the collective field theory. But it turns out that for this, when this integer is 1 and 2, they are in fact classical solutions for collective field theory, which I'll write down, and these are the solutions whose physics we'll try to understand. Since these are obtained by a symmetry transformation of a W infinity transformation starting from the ground state, formally, you can think that these are, in fact, states of a fermion theory, which is represented by something like this, where Q is like the charge, which generates the symmetry. However, these states are not normalizable, so they should be really be thought of as really time-dependent backgrounds and represented by deformations of the Hamiltonian, which is obtained by the similarity transformation. This is, of course, quite standard, and it's the same story in the ADS-CFT correspondence. But the fact that these solutions are generated in this particular fashion means that we have, in principle, an exact way of computing all quantities in this theory. The reason is that in the fermion theory, which around the ground state is something completely solvable, it's a free fermion living in an inverted X-square potential, all physically interesting quantities in string theory can be written in terms of an operator, which is a bilocal operator of fermions, which is written of this form. And by looking at the symmetry transformations, it's easy to see that what I need to compute, that the corresponding operator in around this non-trivial background is related to an operator in the trivial background by a formula like this, which just follows from the definition of this in terms of a Wigner function. Therefore, the theory is completely well formulated in this background, which does not mean that you can always calculate these things, but certainly it's completely well formulated. And calculations can be performed exactly in the fermion theory, for example, in the Wigner function formalism of Dharmandal and Borya. I'll now give you two of the examples and see what does this mean in terms of an emergent spacetime. The first solution is something which I'll call a moving mirror solution. This corresponds to this integer being 1 in that formula which I wrote down. Rather than rewrite what this answer is, let me try to explain that in terms of a picture in the Fermi sheet. So once again, this is a phase space picture. What the solution represents is a moving Fermi sheet, which with infinite past is like the standard ground state, and time evolves in the following fashion. So you can see that the fermions on this side are being drained out to infinity, and the fermions on that side are filling up, you know, the rest of the stuff. And since the place where this thing turns around is in fact the edge of the eigenvalue distribution, what this represents is a moving mirror. For somebody sitting on this side, it's a mirror which is coming towards you. From somebody sitting outside, it's moving away from you. The classical solution of this theory, and by classical solution, I mean the solutions of the collective field theory, can be easily written down from the phase space conditions, and this happens to be the classical solution. And it clearly shows the moving mirror nature of the solution, because after all, the mirror is located at the point where the square root vanishes, and as you can see, that it just goes one way or the other. This also tells you how to write down Minkowski and coordinates for the space-time which is perceived by this by the fluctuations around the solution. I told you that around any classical solution, time-dependent or not, the fluctuations perceive a two-dimensional fluctuations, are massless fluctuations in two-dimensional space-time, and it's convenient, like in any two-dimensional space-time, you would like to go to Minkowski and coordinates, which is like minus d tau of curl d sigma square. And in this case, you can see that just from the solutions and from the transformations, it's easy to guess what these coordinates are. And these happen to be the coordinates. In terms, these are, in fact, what you might consider as co-moving coordinates in the moving mirror problem. The mirror, therefore, in some these coordinates, sigma, sigma is at sigma equal to 0, and the Penrose diagram, therefore, is completely identical to what you had around the ground state. That, of course, is true for the moving mirror problem, which has served as a useful toy example for many, many quantum processes in time-dependent backgrounds. But the real part of the story lies in the fact that in terms of the asymptotic observer, rays which are coming in from infinity and getting reflected off the mirror suffer large red or blue shifts which result in particle production. In this particular case, we can formulate this problem of particle production by specifying what was the analog of the space coordinate at t equal to minus infinity, which is given by the standard, this is the formula around the ground state, which is also the state at t equal to minus infinity. So q is the sigma on psi minus. And in terms of this picture, where time is plotted this way and this coordinate q is plotted this way, this is what the problem looks like from the side in which the mirror is approaching you. So as you can see, the rays getting blue shifted in this case. And the important feature of this is that the mirror actually hits the scry plus at some finite point, which is something which is called the end of time. The relationship between these coordinates q and t and sigma and tau is given by an equation like this, which is a non-trivial transformation between the coordinates, and therefore an initial state which is a vacuum state on scry minus will not remain a vacuum as perceived on scry plus. So this is of course the standard problem of particle production. The only difference here so far is that those transformations are not just ordinary conformal transformations as in the standard moving mirror problem. Now in 1 plus 1 dimensions, the effect of particle production can in fact be calculated by a well-known method, just by looking at the conformal anomaly, the anomalous transformation of the energy momentum tensor. So this is the energy momentum tensor in those asymptotic coordinates q, so tq minus q minus, measured in the in state, is related to t sigma minus by this well-known equation where this is the Schwarzschild derivative. In usual field theory, this quantity is defined by normal ordering, and so almost by definition, this quantity is zero. So as a result, since in the tau and sigma coordinates, the physics is exactly that of the stationary mirror, this is after all the moving coordinate frame, one would therefore conclude, in usual quantum field theory, that the energy momentum flux of particle produced is entirely given by the Schwarzschild derivative. I'm just written out the answer for that. This would mean a flux, because on scry plus, you can calculate this object, and that is zero. So t plus plus is different from t minus minus, which means there is an energy flux which is coming towards you. I will now argue, well, this is the usual argument in field theory, this is completely wrong in string theory. And the reason has got to do with probably one of the most important, well, probably with the reason why we are doing string theory in the first place, namely string theory is ultraviolet finite. Note, this quantity, in fact, this quantity T sigma minus in, which is put to zero in usual field theory by normal ordering, is in fact the one loop contribution to the vacuum energy momentum tensor of the theory. In normal field theory, that's an ambiguous quantity, it's always infinite, this because of the one loop diagram, and that's removing that infinity is what we call normal ordering. But of course, we know that in string theory, we should not do such a thing, because this diagram has an unambiguous answer. In fact, this answer is ambiguous, which is zero in supersymmetric theory, and it's non-zero in non-supersymmetric theories which do not contain a tachyon. In fact, this answer has been calculated long time ago for this particular case, and it just happens to be minus 1 upon 48 pi. So the question we are going to ask, and this is independent of the question of the moving mirror problem, is that how could such an indefinite answer arise in a collective field theory, which after all looks like a field theory, and therefore should have the same kind of one-loop divergences and the same problems as any field theory? That's right. It must be getting softened by the discrete states, but except that I don't know how that happens. I mean, they're not normalizable, that's true. But it is true that if you just calculate this diagram in the wall sheet, you get this answer. There's some, yeah, some UV cutoff which automatically comes, yeah.
Were you saying there's not a conformal anomaly for the stress tensor defined in string theory? Because you can define...
No. There is a conformal anomaly.
You can derive this term just from the conformal anomaly and how, well, that produces the transformation of the stress tensor if you go
state one. Yeah. No, I'm saying absolutely there is a conformal anomaly. The only thing I'm saying is that... Oh, absolutely. So all I'm saying is that in this equation, normally we would put this to zero, almost by definition.
Okay.
And what I'm trying to argue, this should not be put to zero because this is the string theory.
Okay.
And as I'll tell you where it sort of roughly comes from.
Okay. So you still have the...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Because that's, as you say, that's just something basic. So how could it come from a field theory? I mean, this, in fact, used to be one of the big puzzles when I first started working in the subject in the early 90s. And then what we discovered is that what I just wrote down for the collective field theory, which I said is derived just from the matrix model by a transformation which has non-trivial measures and everything, was only the leading large N answer. If you work a little hard, what you find that the subleading terms in large N, namely 1 upon N corrections of the theory, one automatically produces explicit 1 upon N square corrections, which are themselves naturally singular. And what turns out, that when you calculate the vacuum energy of the theory, there are two terms. The first term comes from this explicit 1 upon N square corrections, which is therefore a one-loop correction. And the second term comes from explicitly integrating out the massless scalar field. And when you do the calculation, these combine to produce a finite answer. The divergences cancel out so long as you use the same regularization, leaving with a finite answer, which is exactly minus 1 upon 48 pi. This was one of the crucial pieces of evidences which showed that the matrix model is indeed representing the two-dimensional field theory. So this is an old result. For us, what this means, that in this equation, one should substitute that answer in this formula. And when you do that, you find something interesting. What you find is, recall that the Schwarzschild derivative term gave you a non-trivial answer for the energy momentum flux, whereas this will also give you a term which depends on sigma minus and q minus in some complicated way. You do the calculation, and what you find is that all the non-trivialness cancels away. And you're left with an answer which is exactly the answer as in the ground state. And this is the answer in the ground state. Tq plus q plus n is also exactly that value, which would mean that there is no energy flux due to particle production. How could this have happened? The way, of course, this happened is that particles are produced by the mirror, which carries some energy as they are coming towards you. But the fact that there is a constant vacuum energy density means that in the moving frame, that also considers a flux, which is negative. And in this particular case, they seem to exactly cancel off, leading with particle production, but no fluxes. Now, I don't know whether this has any lessons. Do I have? You probably have, but I don't. Right, that's right. We did check, but it's a little more difficult. Let me come to the higher values of R, and then maybe I'll mention. What is interesting is that in this rather simple toy example, which seems to have hardly anything to do with higher dimensional string theory, one does discover that in a very nice physical effect, one of the most important effects in time-dependent backgrounds, there is a uniquely stringy signature. Because after all, the fact that this one-loop energy is finite is a string, is one of the basic things about string theory. In the matrix model, it reflects itself in some ugly 1 upon n square corrected terms, which gives rise to this result. Now, before leaving this subject, I would mention that I had so far just considered in this discussion only time asymmetric solutions, namely something which starts at t equal to minus infinity on the ground states and evolves into something. You can do the other thing, consider time symmetric solutions, and what one ends up is construction of some Hartle-Hawking vacua as produced by these authors. So now let's come to something a little more interesting. The second solution which I'll consider, again in phase space, looks something like this. We call this a closing hyperbola solution, done with Joanna. So at time equal to minus infinity, once again it's a ground state, and as time evolves, this thing bends onto itself and just closes onto itself at infinite time. Once again, you can write down what are the classical solutions of the which correspond classical solutions of the collective field theory, and these are the classical solutions. And in such a situation, you might try to figure out how does a small ripple in fact proceed in phase space. That's not very hard to do. It's given by an equation like this, and I'm trying to draw a picture like that. This, in fact, is the exact trajectory of a little fermion which is sitting on top of the Fermi surface. Solves the equation of motion with some given initial conditions. And it is clear from this, tau naught is a parameter which tells you where this fermion started off from. And for all values of tau naught, the ripples turn back and turn into the large X region. So in a way, it is actually very similar to the kind of solutions we have been considering, ripples coming in, bouncing back at in infinite time. The space-time interpretation of this, and I'll specify what I mean by the space-time of this, is in fact quite different. In order to figure out what the space-time interpretation, we'd like to draw some Penrose diagrams. So we'll use these three steps, which we did exactly for the other two cases. First, we are going to determine the conformal class of the metric in which the fluctuations live. Then we are going to obtain Minkowskian coordinates, which will turn in handy to draw Penrose diagrams. In this case, the Minkowskian coordinates are given by this following formula, and as opposed to the previous two cases, the Minkowskian time tau is related to the matrix model time t in a pretty non-trivial manner, which has the effect that as the matrix model time, which is the time which is the basic time in the theory, which goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, giving you time evolution, this time tau goes from minus infinity to zero. And it appears that space-time is ending on a space-like thing at tau equal to zero. Now, normally, this is nonsense, because you have a Minkowskian space minus d tau squared by d sigma squared, and just cut it off at some tau equal to zero. That, of course, makes it geodesically incomplete. And you would say that, well, we have just forgotten to continue it beyond tau equal to zero. But in this case, let me remind you, space and time are derived concepts. This is not something which we were given to you to begin with. In fact, there was no relativity, no relativistic invariance to begin with. We had a system of some non-relativistic fermions in moving in some space. And somehow we are trying to reinterpret the system in terms of fluctuations in a relativistic theory with some backgrounds. In this interpretation, therefore, the problem, in our problem, the fundamental definition is, in fact, in terms of the matrix model, which time evolution is the time t, and it doesn't make sense to go beyond t equal to infinity. If we draw the Penrose diagram, you, of course, get something like that, which you would never draw in anything else. There is an incoming ray which gets reflected and goes off to the space-like boundary. And once again, these coordinates, as I mentioned, I'm always going to choose coordinates in which the interaction Hamiltonian is time-independent. So that's a kind of the principle. And these are, in fact, in exact correspondence to the fermion trajectories. And then you find a bit of a surprise when you look at this look at this picture as opposed to the picture which you got in XT space. Let me remind you, in XT space we found, just by looking at the profiles of the Fermi surface, that every ripple comes in, gets reflected and comes back. Now it's clear from this picture that doesn't seem to happen in this kind of space-time, quote-unquote space-time, which is defined by tau and sigma. In fact, this particular ray, which has a tau naught, the parameter, the retarded time, greater than zero, never, in fact, hits the mirror. So what's going on? If you look at closely, what you in fact find, of course, in X space, every pulse always turns back. And in fact, if you look at it, look at those equations, what you discover is that it in fact turns back before it reaches what we call sigma equal to zero. It is turning back because the Fermi surface itself is evolving in time, and this thing is riding on the Fermi surface. The Fermi surface is sort of closing on itself, and it sort of takes it for a ride, and which is the basic reason why in the space-time, which you have invented in this theory, you get a rather different picture of what is happening. If this is not worse enough, let me come to the second example. In all the examples, I always had a mirror. The mirror could be static, the mirror could be moving. Singular? No, I didn't get that.
Let's say you have a two-point function somehow in the matrix moment in which one of the citations here is telling you to do boundary.
I should mention. I should mention, in this particular case, I forgot to write down the formula for the interaction Hamiltonian. The coupling is strong here. This is not a space-like boundary which is asymptotic in the sense that the coupling is weak. The coupling is weak in these regions, which are very far away from here, right? So if you want to really see what is going on here, this is something which is sort of work in progress. You really have to do the calculations in the exact fermion theory and not in this collective field approximation.
Actually, raise that question. Is anything in the exact fermion theory which causes the dynamics freeze, you know, close to at large time? Or is there still dynamics going on even though there's no time elapsing in this?
Actually, I don't know the answer to that. This is something which I'm trying to understand. I mean even though in things, principle things are computable, is rather difficult, and I always don't have the muscle to do that. So where did I lose my... Oh, sorry. My disappearing mirror disappeared. It's back again. Possibly do that. I'd rather not do it this way because I sort of know what the boundary conditions are and I'm just following those trajectories. That's interesting. I mean, I haven't thought of it that way. So as I said, in all those examples, there was a mirror which could be static, which could be moving, accelerating, which could, you know, close on itself, do all kinds of things. But now I'm going to talk about a solution where the mirror actually disappears after some time. So here is the profile of the Fermi surface. At minus infinity, normal thing. And in my choice of parameters of the zero of time and chosen rescale various quantities, at the matrix model time, t equal to zero, the Fermi surface sort of looks like that. Beyond that, as you can see, there is no place where there is a mirror. There's no edge of the distribution, which is quite evident from the form of the classical solution, which I have displayed here. In fact, the classical solution appears to be singular at the point where the mirror disappears. However, the physics of the problem, in fact, tells you nothing singular can be going on here, because if we just follow a small ripple, it just goes on a hyperbola and goes smoothly through t equal to zero. If there is anything singular, it might happen at t equal to plus infinity, but certainly not at this point, t equal to zero. This, in fact, manifests itself when you try to analyze the space-time which is produced by the solution. And what you find, that you need two patches of Minkowski space in order to describe the physics. The first patch is given at t less than 0 with some coordinates which looks like that, and again a time which is related to the Minkowski time in some non-trivial fashion. The time interval minus infinity 0 in fact covers the entire interval of this time tau going from minus infinity to plus infinity. So this is sort of appearing sort of like a horizon. So what we have is a this for times less than 0 so far we got the Penrose diagram, which looks pretty much like what we had before, except this is not really a scribe class, this is more like a horizon, and you should extend the space-time beyond that. Once again, normally you might be tempted to end the space-time on this null surface, but of course the matrix model tells you that the space-time should be continued. It's pretty much like, if we didn't know that Rindler space is actually Minkowski space, you might want to end the space-time in one of the patches, but then you know that it's Minkowski, so it's continuous. For times greater than 0, there is another patch of the Minkowski space-time, which sort of looks like this, and once again, what you discover is that when the fundamental time t goes from 0 to infinity, this Minkowski time goes from minus infinity to 0. Pretty much like the other solution in this next patch. And once again, the matrix model tells us that it is meaningless to extend the space-time beyond tau equal to 0. I must emphasize once again that tau and sigma are of course determined after conformal transformations. However, it is in these coordinates that the Hamiltonian, the full Hamiltonian of the theory is time-independent, and so that makes the physics rather transparent. The boundary, so this should be tau equal to 0, is not an asymptotic region. Interactions, however, don't blow up naively. They don't remain small, but they do remain small for large values of sigma, which tells you that on that space-like surface, I mean, to do most of the physics, you should actually do some exact calculations in the fermion theory. Yes, that's right. Well, what you would call a finite affine parameter. It's just like cutting off space like that, so you could start geodesically incomplete. Yeah. Like the previous example, the notion of what is happening, as the picture of what is happening in space-time can get completely convoluted because of this fact. For example, things which seem to get reflected in X space are not reflected, and the other way around. I'll skip the details of that, but rather give you what you might draw as the Penrose diagram for this space-time. So the diagram looks like this. This is a patch of Minkowski space for t less than 0. So this is the two scribe minuses. So these are the surfaces of t equal to 0 with sigma minus minus infinity, sigma plus plus infinity. And then you attach another half of Minkowski space and identify this with that. So a ray coming in like this goes off like that. Ray coming in like this goes off like that. And something which is not surprising, that if you label this null rays by a retarded time tau naught for values of the tau naught greater than 0, the ray crosses over to the other side in X space. Of course, what it must mean in string theory is that an initial tachyon pulse, for example, metamorphoses into a mixture of a tachyon and an action, which can happen because there are these backgrounds.
What happens to that corner?
Here? No. This entire thing has to be identified with this. You sort of cut it up and paste it. There's nothing here.
No, I know, but right at the vertex
juncture. Oh, here.
Yeah.
It's kind of a conical. Actually, I don't know. I don't think anything special is happening, but it sort of does look like a conical defect kind of thing. But this maybe just looks like that because this is the way we are drawing it. As I just said, at least there is no singularity in anything at t equal to 0. That you can just see from the fermion picture. So I would guess that there is no singularity at this point. but I'm not completely sure of this. Oh, because the background itself contains, it's a condensate, I'll sort of come to this, a condensate of tachyons, right? So when you, the cubic terms in the theory, you know, the interaction terms will sort of automatically do this. Of course, in this whole game, one of the main questions is what if we have talked about a space and a time, which we have invented from the matrix model. Even if we didn't know anything about string theory, we could have still done that. One interesting question is that how are these things related to the standard target space of the two-dimensional string? And this, as you know, is a rather tricky question with no clear answer. For fluctuations of the ground state, the target space fields are related to the collective field by a non-local map, which I mentioned above. The kernel of this map is determined by matching the S matrices, and they are known in the asymptotic region. They go by the name of leg poles, and in fact, as Polchinski and Natsume in the mid-90s beautifully showed, that it are these non-local transformations which encode gravitational interactions in this model. This is the one which tells you that one pulse going gravitationally interacts with another pulse. The problem is that while we do know this answer for fluctuations around the ground state, and we know the answer because you can have computations on both sides and compare the computations, as far as I know, we sort of lack a general principle which determines these transformations. It's not surprising that we lack a general principle, because after all, the problem must be related to the problem of understanding the discrete states of the theory, which are in fact causing these gravitational interactions. So for our time-dependent backgrounds, the best we can do at the moment is to make an educated guess. And we're going to make a guess by using something which seems to work in many situations. And this is something which goes by the name of the macroscopic loop operator, which is written as a kind of a transform of this collective field. And then you sort of realize that the tachyon background of the standard target space string theory would be related to this quantity by this equation. The way I've defined this quantity is, this tachyon background, as defined by this equation, this phi sort of is the conventional target Liouville mode on the world sheet, and it in fact has been realized recently defines a target space as proved by the FZZT brains of the theory. You can do this calculation for the ground state, and you get this answer phi e to the minus 2 phi, which is the right condensate, once again as argued by Polchinski. And this has turned out to be useful in some recent work in minimal string theory by these authors. So you can write answers for this just by blindly doing this calculation of this tachyon condensate for the two cases which seem to be interesting to us. And what you notice, so this is the answer, for example, for the closing hyperbola. What you find is that this is the term which is the standard ground state tachyon condensate. And there is this term here which is independent of phi. So what it must denote, what we think it denotes, is a space-like tachyon condensation. And there is a similar thing for the other condensate. So this, in a sense, is an example of a space-like tachyon condensation in the theory. I'll just take one more minute. Just one transparency left. However, I'm pretty sure this is not the whole story. I'm pretty sure that in terms of the standard target space fields of string theory, the background is likely to contain some higher string modes, and what we need to really understand are the discrete states in the matrix model formalism. Now, this is a sort of a black box, but there's some recent work which seem to indicate that there are some relationships between this discrete state and the non-singlet sector of the matrix model. Some work in progress, which I'd rather not talk about, which is probably wrong. Conclusion. I think you should view our results as an exercise in constructing space and time from matrices. We'd like to hope it's a useful exercise which can be insightful in other circumstances. The relationship of this with the space-time in the usual formulation of Potowitz string theory is not so clear. For example, we found that there are holographic descriptions of space-time which seem to have space-like boundaries. I must warn you that all these conclusions have been obtained when purely at the classical level, and as I have noted, at the space-time boundary, space-like boundaries is not really like an asymptotic region. I mean, the theory is coupled. So the problem has to be solved, possibly non-perturbatively, and luckily, as I have argued, by the way the solutions are constructed, at least the problem is completely well posed. I mean, you can perform calculations in the matrix theory. I mean, I might not be good enough to do that, but somebody might be able to do it. And the hope is that we'll teach us something about the stringy quantum corrections in these regions.